I'm Doug Ginsburg, and I'm just moderating this now that I've got you all moderated. We have a program with four speakers, and we're starting 7 minutes late, but we have to end on time. So we're going to begin in one moment. The biographies of our panelists are in your program materials, so we're not going to spend time on that. I can assure you that all of them, without any known exception, attended college and then also went to law school. Some of them did other things after that, others not. It doesn't matter. They're here now. We're going to go in alphabetical order, which means I'm out of turn already, starting with John Duffy. Maybe it's by age. I don't know, John.
John's older. You were in my class.
John?
I don't think I ever was.
The microphone will expire in 12 minutes.
Okay, the topic of our panel today is competition in the patent system. And I want to begin with a very, very basic point about the patent system. It often is said, and you can find many, many sources that say, that patents are a restriction on competition. And I think that that is fundamentally wrong. Patents are structuring of competition, and that's an enormously different function that it serves. It is not designed to create monopolies in the sense of the old sense of the word, of bad monopolies, of handing out royal favorites. There was a time, perhaps a brief period of time in England, when the patents or letters patent were just given out on existing products and were designed to raise prices of existing products and favor certain groups or certain individuals who curried favor with the crown. That's not the way our patent system works. Because of basic features of the patent system, first of all, there is free entry into the race to obtain patents. Patent systems are often characterized as a system that encourages racing. And that is one of the major benefits of the patent system. There's a constant competition to get technology sooner in time. And as my writings have emphasized, getting technology sooner in time through the patent system also has a benefit that many people forget about, which is that the sooner that the technology is patented, the sooner it enters into the public domain. Because patent terms are strictly limited. 20 years currently from time of filing with more than 17 usually. 20 years from filing and some additions for delays in the patent system. That means that the race to obtain patents is really a race to place things into the public domain and to enrich the public domain. It is not a restriction on the public domain. It is a system that is designed to foster putting new things into the public domain. This has a very specific benefit in terms of a very specific implication for current policy debates. There are some scholars who've tried to measure the benefits of the patent system by looking at the effects on company profits of obtaining patents, with the conclusion of these scholars being that the cost to the companies, including litigation costs when they get sued for patents, the costs associated with the patent system outweigh any benefits of the patent system. Therefore, the patent system is a net negative for society. One important feature that they are omitting is any attempt to measure the public benefits from the new products, the consumer surplus that arises because of a new product. It's very hard to measure a consumer surplus that arises. So like many economists, if the light is bad over there and you can't see it and you can't measure it, you go where the light is good. But that's not the right way to look at this system, because most of the benefits of the patent system are not for the private companies. Private companies, whether they obtain patents or don't obtain patents, are most likely to obtain normal economic profits. In other words, they're going to compete away all potential super competitive profits, whether we have a patent system or whether we don't have a patent system. The beneficiaries of the patent system are not private companies. They are instead the public, which obtains better technology sooner, and the public domain, which ultimately obtains the technology when the patent expires. So that's something very important to remember in terms of thinking about the competition for patents, that the competition for patents is a competition ultimately to enrich the public domain at an earlier period of time. The second point I wanted to talk about today is that it is sometimes said, and indeed Justice Breyer said this just a couple years ago in an oral argument at the Supreme Court. He said there's a few things we know for sure about the patent system, and he said some favorable things about this patent system, and some of the negatives, and one key negative he listed was that patents raise prices. Well, okay.
Explain that.
I need to explain it. Okay. This is said very often, and the key flaw in this logic is to realize that the assertion that patents raise prices assumes that the technology would exist anyway. And that, of course, is the key assumption, that if we could say that the technology would exist anyway, then, of course, it is true that we should not have a patent on that. In other words, if you could get technology or some development without a patent system, then you would not want to patent it. Now, in fact, current law doctrine, as articulated by the Supreme Court, specifically has a doctrine codified in statute which says that if a patent is so easy to think up, so obvious, in the words of the statute, that it would, according to the Supreme Court, it would be created anyway, created and disclosed anyway, without the inducement of the patent system, then current Supreme Court doctrine says that patent is obvious and should not be granted a patent. So the assertion that patents raise prices assumes that the technology must exist already. And that assumption is, I think, fundamentally inconsistent with current statutory law and current Supreme Court precedent. It is not, and I have a large article on this in the Yale Law Journal from a couple years ago, playing out the implications of that insight and suggesting ways in which current doctrine could perhaps be modified to make sure that this is always true, and talking about some nuances on that. But it is important to remember, when you hear this assertion that patents raise prices, that is making a fundamental logical error about the structure of the patent system that goes to the larger point that patents are not a restriction on competition, but are instead a structuring of a competition. The last point that I want to make in terms of the patent system in my dwindling number of minutes here is that the patent system is designed to induce the creation of a certain kind of information that we think otherwise would not be protected by other property rights, traditional property rights, including rights like trade secret. And that kind of information is information that has a large benefit to the public, but nonetheless has certain public good aspects. And by public good aspects, I mean that it is something that other people relatively easily, in the absence of intellectual property rights, could relatively easily free ride on, and therefore there wouldn't be a public benefit to obtain, there wouldn't be any private incentive in the absence of an intellectual property system to create this kind of information. The Supreme Court and our current doctrine says that the goal of the patent system is to foster disclosure of this type of information, disclosure of this kind of information that otherwise would not be produced in the absence of the patent system. I want to just say that one caveat on today's patent system is we have to think very hard about what kind of information we want to have disclosed and what kind of information we are fostering. We seek to foster the disclosure of, and how it gets disclosed. Information disclosure is actually very, very difficult. It's not very easy to just simply say, here's a bunch of paper, and I'll disclose it to you, and now you know it. Disclosure of information and teaching of information, we often talk about the teachings of the patent within the patent field. Teaching is hard. It's time-consuming. It's difficult. I know this firsthand, because I've had the experience of going through an entire semester trying my best to teach my material from my casebook. And then at the end of the semester, I read the exams and realize...
Bad casebook.
I've not been... No, that's my casebook. I wasn't talking about your casebook.
Oh,
that one I have no trouble with. The type of the way in which disclosure occurs in a patent system, I think we do need some rethinking of. There was an old doctrine that I've just written about called the paper patent doctrine, which generally speaking said that patents that are merely paper, that have never been practiced, that don't teach very well within that paper, are disfavored in the patent system, as compared to inventions that have been practiced in which an inventor or an entrepreneur has taught a workforce. It turns out this doctrine was incredibly balanced. If you looked at all appellate cases, and there are about 140 of those appellate cases, they divide right down the middle about between people who are using them this doctrine defensively to attack patents that were being asserted against them, and also and the other half was used by inventors who were trying to say that old patents, that the patent office was saying, oh, this has already been done, or, you know, it's obvious in light of these older patents, that they were saying that their invention was different because these old patents were just paper patents. So it was used both in a pro-patent and in an anti-patent way, which is what you'd expect of a rather fundamental disclosure theory like this. And I think the insight of this doctrine, which has been lost to modern law, the insight of this doctrine was that disclosure is difficult, and that the information we're trying to encourage the development in society is not just files of paper in the patent office. It's new technology brought to practice, new entrepreneurial technology, new production of technology, the inculcation of methods inside a workforce, and that is really the goal of what we're trying to obtain in a patent system. This is a doctrine that was very favorable to entrepreneurs. People who actually went out there and built a business loved this doctrine because it made it easier for them to get their patents and easier for them to have their patents sustained. And entrepreneurs would like it because if they got attacked by what today we might call a patent troll, somebody who had a patent, might have sat in the patent office for years, it was never practiced, and then they wait for somebody else to do the hard work of actually building a successful product, and then they assert a patent right that has never been practiced anywhere. Those entrepreneurs had a defense. They could use this doctrine called the paper patent doctrine. And I think that doctrine should be revived. I have a lengthy article on that. Of course, I'm an academic. I'm going to market my articles to you. A lengthy article on that. But it is, I think, a conservative doctrine. In the sense, I'm here at a conservative convention, it is an older doctrine that has been forgotten in modern law, and I think it needs to be revived. So those are my points, and my time is up perfectly.
Perfect. Thank you. All right, well, Richard Epstein, you're next. Richard has a lot to say and 12 minutes in which to say it. We'll see what happens.
I want to thank my former student for being such a diligent moderator, and I want to thank John for using such a wonderful torts casebook. But I also, following John is in some sense a real honor because he doesn't raise my blood pressure talking about patents, which already makes him one of the very few in the elite on this particular subject matter. And I want to begin with the 1952 Patent Act because I think it starts to tell you how we ought to think about this problem. The 1952 Patent Act is much better than the peculiar confection called the 2011 Propagandistic America Invents Act. And you have to understand the process by which it was passed. In about 1946 or 1947, Harry Truman says, Pasquale and Giles, what I would like you guys to do is to draft me a new patent act. Some of these statutes, that cases we have in the Supreme Court aren't so good. So these two guys sit down and they draft a very fine statute. It goes to the Senate in 1952 in the House, and it passes by voice vote, acclamation in both cases, and goes into effect 1953. Total cost of getting the bill into effect is probably about $100,000. You take the modern statute and it proves the following proposition. The more people who have stakeholders and interest in this situation, the more likely it is that they're going to massively screw up. And it's clear from my own involvement in this particular case that this was a billion or more kind of propaganda effort on the part of everybody on every side of the issue. The proposition that we generally draw from all of this is that the ability or the conscientiousness or the effectiveness or the soundness of a statute is inverse to the amount of money that it takes to get the thing through, at least in this case. Now, the question then is, why is it that the old guys got it right and the new guys started to get it wrong? And I think the way in which you do that is to sort of take the three terms in sequence, intellectual property, free markets, and competition policy, to see the way in which a patent system ought to be put together. I'm very much of the firm belief that you cannot do patent law unless you understand a great deal about property law more generally. I don't think intellectual property is one word unrelated to property. I think intellectual property is a subset of standard property. And one of the insights that you draw from that is the question of what do we mean by exclusive rights as an ownership matter as opposed to exclusive rights as a monopoly matter. And if you go to the real estate cases, you know, Richard Epstein owns apartment 3502 at 800 North Michigan Avenue, and it turns out I have a monopoly in that particular property. But on the other hand, there are lots of other houses which are rather similar. And so the exclusive rights there does not represent any kind of market power. And so the assertion that simply because you have a monopoly in a particular asset means that you have market power is demonstrably wrong with respect to real estate. And it turns out, for a reason, some of which John Duffy mentioned, it's demonstrably wrong with respect to the way in which you think about the patent system. You get a patent on one state, and it's in competition with a whole other number of drugs in exactly the same class, and that competition is going to start to force the price down. People desperately want to increase the level of profits that they get from their patents, so they're trying to get them onto the market earlier than otherwise be the case. And generally speaking, as a welfare matter, you would rather a patentee get monopoly rents for a short period, and the consumers get some profit in that same period, then it turns out that nobody gets anything during that particular period. And it also turns out to be the case that the sooner you get this thing on and you make the disclosure, the more likely it is that a competitive drug will use that disclosure and come onto the same market. So the way in which you control monopoly profit is to essentially create a system which is relatively congenial to new entry. One of the real dangers, of course, with the FDA, a menace in many ways more than one, is that to the extent that you have these very difficult entry rules with respect to clinical trials, it turns out that what you do is you create monopolies through a second system, which are much more dangerous than those that are created through the patent system themselves. And yet the number of people who are prepared on intellectual property grounds to give a close look at the FDA is virtually minuscule amongst the very people who think that the patent system itself suffers from some very difficult kind of difference. So then the question is, well, how do you want to understand this property right that you have with respect to the patents? And I think the simplest and most powerful explanation is as follows. Patents are something over information for an invention. Generally speaking, at some point, the information can be given to somebody else while retained by the original owner so that it becomes, in some sense, a quasi-public good. The issue is, what do we do with this insight? Well, the one thing is it makes it very clear that perpetual ownership, which is the appropriate situation for land, is in fact not the ideal model with respect to intellectual property. And therefore, what you have to do is to figure out what adaptation you make. The basic rule in all cases is make as few adaptations and modifications of a fundamentally sound system, namely that with respect to real property, that is needed to take into account this defect. And as a matter of first approximation, the single most important of these is that what you do is you set term limits with respect to patents, and you have to pick what the optimal year turns out to be. Now, generally speaking, you could go either too long or too short. If you're worried about software, don't worry about patent length. Even if you made it 5 years, it's too long, because these things have very short half-lives. So the key feature is figuring out how to get them onto the market as quickly as possible. But if you're doing something like pharma and you go a little bit too short, you're really costing a very great deal. And so generally speaking, you'd like to move that a little bit further to the long side. And what's happened with the FDA approval system as it interacts with the patent system is that it turns out it effectively shortens the rate of these properties, or the life of these properties, to around 11 and a half years, 10 years, something in that level, which is probably too short for optimal incentives with respect to the development in question. But once you make this fundamental adjustment, then the last thing you want to do is to be fancy Dan about other attributes associated with property. And the two, I think, or the three, actually, that are most important are, one of the rules with respect to acquisitions, and I'm going to state for the purpose of the argument that patent examination is a perfectly good way to start, and the more reliable the examination, the more likely it is that the patent system will operate effectively downstream through licensing of one form or another. It is therefore a matter of high folly that what the major blockade in this system is insufficient funding of the public resources needed to keep the office going well, so that you get delays on the one hand and inaccuracies on the other. And if you wanted to change things, you didn't need the American Invents Act. You needed to double the appropriation so as to get decent patent examiners with respect to the way in which they work. The second thing that you're worried about with respect to patents is to make sure that, like real estate, nobody has an incentive to bypass the system. And the traditional rule that you get an injunction unless there was something that the patentee did that forfeited the situation by way of estoppel or laches or contract or something to force was, in fact, the right approach with respect to this situation. And indeed, one of the things that's so important about it is not that you want to get the injunction, but you want to make sure that you have a legal system in which it's no longer necessary to get the injunction because, in effect, nobody has an incentive to bolt. People talk all the time about the holdout problem or the holdup problem. They do not talk enough about the reverse holdup problem, which is, in my view, every bit as severe. There hasn't been too much of that historically, and the reason is because the injunction system stopped that in its tracks, and one of the major difficulties of the modern law in this area is it doesn't recognize that there are two forms of peril, and yet everybody who does injunctions in the real property cases knows that that's, in fact, a serious issue. In addition, everybody knows who works with injunctions in real property that the rule is not an injunction or damages. Oftentimes, you can have very elaborate, nuanced injunctions coupled with damages to get rid of the most insidious part of the injunctive remedy without throwing away the farm. And yet, the discussions of eBay are largely devoid of how it is that these intermediate solutions ought to work. A mistake. The second feature that you want is to make sure that you can license these things. Essentially, if you have a patent and you can license it freely and can enforce the license by actions if need be, what you do is you increase the gains that you can get from the use of that patent, which is a stronger incentive to create it in the first place. So when the Supreme Court in a bunch of cases like Quanta and so forth finds all sorts of reasons why there are limitations of the first sale rule and the license rules and so forth with respect to licensing and sales, what they do is they reduce the utility of the patent and it backs up into the system and gets it going in exactly the wrong way. If you're talking about real estate, the injunctive rules and the licensing rules for entry and so forth are pretty good. Just follow them in this case. Don't try to mess them up in a way that you could then say, it's correcting for whatever defects there are in the original patenting process. The errors never cancel out. They always accumulate, leaving us worse off than before. So if you get intellectual property right, it turns out that you're going to get the free markets right and you're going to get the competition policy right. The key point here is not to worry about the issue as to whether or not when you have this particular patent it creates some sort of a mythical monopoly. What you're worried about is whether or not you get two guys, each of whom has their own patent control, and decide to collude in some particular way in order to raise the price cooperatively. So if all the guys who made all the different statements got together and decided to restrict output and raise prices and have a single marketing agency, that's a serious antitrust violation. And indeed, for the most part, the rules from the 1990s about how it is that you can pool patents, allowing you to pool complements but not substitutes, is a very sensible accommodation. Pooling the complements gets you away from the various problems of the double marginalization issue in which patents blockade one another. Pooling substitutes for one another starts to allow you to get some kind of a cartel. So what you have to do essentially to keep this game in perfectly equilibrium is to understand that the competition policy you need in order to make sure that free markets work is just the plain old antitrust rule as applied to the basic overall situation. So what does this start to tell us? To me, it says that one of the great tragedies of modern times is we have too much scholarship with respect to intellectual property. And the problem about this scholarship is it becomes deeply introspective, and what it does is it takes a perfectly beautiful structure, puts it under a microscope, and sees every pore and deformity in the system at this minor level, and then blows them up out of all proportion. What people need to do is to take a tranquilizer, to relax, to look at the overall situation, and to realize that the talk of patent thickets and trolls and so forth has been around for 20 years, and the patent system, at least until 2011, worked well. That's because they're overstating difficulties, and they overstate difficulties because they do not understand the fundamental economic logic of all property systems, and therefore they don't understand it with respect to intellectual property. So count me as a dissenter from the modern establishment on this area. Thank you.
So first, I want to thank the Federalist Society for inviting me. It's a particular privilege to be on a panel with such distinguished experts on these issues. I haven't written on those issues, so I won't refer you to my published works. But if you want to look at some of my published works on patent law, they indeed will raise your blood pressure. But what I'm about to say will certainly raise Professor Epstein, so hopefully he can stay calm until everything is over. I'm going to actually start as my foil, the guy on my left, your right, Josh Wright, who was writing about the role of antitrust in regulating patent assertion entities, commonly referred to as patent trolls. Antitrust is not a form of comprehensive price regulation. Rather, the antitrust laws are concerned with conduct that reduces competition. Changes in pricing incentives that do not arise from changes in competition are outside the appropriate scope of antitrust, and I am happy, as an unrepentant liberal adoptedly visiting Chicago, not a member of the Chicago School, to say that patent law and antitrust law are back in the business of price regulation. To quote the subtitle of my favorite movie, Dr. Strangelove, it's time to how I learned to stop worrying and love the bomb. So, first, if you look at patent law doctrine itself, it turns out that in certain specific cases, judges are valuing the patent infringement right itself, and that requires court intervention and thus price regulation. When does this occur? Well, it typically occurs in the context where you have infringement by a direct competitor. Normally, we assume that in those circumstances, there's a premise of irreparable harm that should grant an injunction. And this is because why? Because in most circumstances, outside the context of standards bodies and a few other things like patent pools, which I'll come to later, we assume direct competitors will not license each other. However, what is the remedy? Well, first you get your damages for lost profits, but on top of that, you get a remedy for reasonable royalties on the licenses you would have never made. This is not economic valuation of harm to the patent holder, therefore, nor is it unjust enrichment, disgorgement of the patentee's profits. It's valuation of an intrusion on a government-granted legal right, which doesn't in fact harm the patent holder except in regard to potential revenues they wouldn't have made anyway. So what are we doing? We're basically giving it to a jury just like what's an arm worth when there isn't a market there. Of necessity, the government has to set a fair price. The fair price does so through a highly flawed jury system that looks to this counterfactual world of ex-ante negotiations under the Georgia Pacific standard in a context where they assume royalty rates are going to be based on judgments about the patent itself. Well, the patent itself, for the purposes of this hypothetical and unrealistic royalty, is assumed to be both valid and infringed, and of course, in any bilateral ex-ante negotiation, there's some probability it will not be valid, nor will it be infringed. That just gets thrown out of this calculation when determining reasonableness, and we try to set a patent on the product itself and a value for it. This is particularly difficult in regard to trying to figure out the inventive contribution of a small component to a larger system that's sold. And I'll come back to that later. It also raises the difficult issues of royalty stacking when multiple patents are involved in the ultimate products that's sold, but only one person is suing each other. Okay, so much for basic patent law. Let's turn to antitrust and its relation to the patent litigation system. We now have these settlements, particularly in the context of drugs, which Professor Posner again pointed to, where pioneering and branded drugs are paying generic companies to stay off the market. It's through an advance notice, advanced new drug application, they can get onto the market and get approval to get onto the market within 30 days unless there's an injunction out of the court to keep them off the market and the patent suit is resolved. This is big money, and often these days, as the FTC has been complaining, big money is changing hands because what they're effectively doing is delaying entry of the generic, keeping the super monopoly prices, and therefore transferring some of the value, in some cases even more value than the generic could have made if they entered the market, just to delay entry, which is bad both for competition and, of course, for consumers. Obviously, this raises a difficult question. What's the appropriate way to look at these things? And some courts had adopted what was called the scope of the patent test for antitrust immunity, which said that if what was being done is exclusion that's within the scope of the patent rights, then of course you can settle on any terms you like. Thankfully, the Supreme Court has seen the wisdom of reversing that and gone to a difficult rule of reason analysis in the recent activist case under a Section 1 Sherman Act restraint of trade approach. This questions will now obviously arise not just in the case where money goes back and forth to the generic, but also you just simply have a pay for delay in the form of not entry, and maybe the generic then will get back into the market at a later time, earlier than the patent would have expired, and somebody is going to have to value what was the comparative benefits of the settlement, what value changed hands, and who's going to do that valuation? The government, also known as people like the gentleman to my immediate left, your right, judges who are going to take these cases, who are going to have to make these difficult decisions. So just to give you a concrete example from activists, Solvay, which had patented Androgel, sued activists, now Watson, certified under this paragraph 4 procedure that the patent was invalid. It got its ANDA approval after 30 months. Another generic, Paddock, filed an ANDA. Another generic called Par agreed to share litigation costs. They entered into a settlement. Activists agreed not to enter in the market for about 65 months before patent expiration and to promote Androgel. Paddock and Par made similar agreements. $12 million went from Solvay to Paddock, $60 million to Par, and somewhere between $19 and $30 million annually for 9 years to activists. Normally, when you don't have the problem of delay onto the market because of the regulatory overstructure, people aren't going to be spending money to have the person suing them go away. Normally, it goes the other way. Money changes hands the other way. In any event, the court says, in the context of this stuff, given these factors, it would be incongruous to determine antitrust legality by measuring the settlement's anti-competitive effects solely against patent law policy, rather than by measuring them against pro-competitive antitrust policies as well. This court has indicated that patent and antitrust policies are both relevant in determining the scope of the patent monopoly and consequently antitrust immunity that's conferred by a patent. Similarly, both within the settlement context and without, the court has struck down overly restrictive patent licensing agreements. Irrespective of whether those agreements produce super patent-permitted revenues, it would be difficult to reconcile the proposed right to settle on any terms with the patent-related policy of eliminating unwarranted patent grants, so the public will not continually be required to pay tribute to would-be monopolists. So I'm going to hurry and leave most of the discussion, which I assume can be addressed by former Professor Wright, on what the ways we're now going to have to make these difficult decisions. But the main thing is that courts are now going to have to balance two things: what the value was being exchanged, and they will inevitably have to weigh the likelihood that the patent was going to be successful. And there's simply no way to avoid, because you don't know whether or not what you were actually exchanging is a valid challenge which would have freed the public entirely, or something else, which is an effort to basically restrict the market. Finally, I'm going to turn to enforcing contractual standard-setting organization commitments for FRAN royalties. Again, as Josh Wright has argued, one needs to consider these commitments in the context of incomplete contracting that's sufficient because of the lack of ability to determine prices ex ante and the need to coordinate technology. For these types of things, we now have a decision out of Judge Robart in the Microsoft versus Motorola case. I won't go through the facts. I'll just give you two basic premises. Motorola offered Microsoft royalties at 2.5% of the end price of the products. The judge ultimately set the royalties at 0.555 cents per unit, substantially lower. And the assumption that's behind this is that the Fran royalty, as a contractual matter, required that in the judges enforcing contracts determine what was a fair offer, because you had to have a good faith offer, and when the good faith offer had not been made, to actually set a reasonable royalty. That's what RAN stands for. Tries to lay out some economic guideposts. What are these economic guideposts for RAND? Well, ultimately, we go back to the Georgia-Pacific factors, which I started with. And so what we're going to have happen, of course, now is when these standard-setting bodies predictably and necessarily can't reach agreement, we'll now have to go to the judges to set what is supposed to be a multilateral decision, which includes royalty stacking considerations, which includes the obligation to license in good faith in this ex-ante negotiation. That judge-based determination will then inform what people do privately. So it's really the judges, again, determining what the fair price is, which will then filter into the market and filter back again. So one thing that one could hope is that the private sector, these SSO bodies, will take this on their own and take it out of the courts, or put it into arbitration to take it out of the courts. Of course, when they take it on themselves, then we get price-fixing concerns. So there's no way to avoid this problem. Finally, I just want to add that there more attention may be needed to be given to market definition. There's some good recent scholarship which seems to suggest that in IP areas, there may be the entire market may actually be in the patent itself or the trademark, et cetera. The question comes up, how much would you pay to substitute Coke for Pepsi? And it turns out that it doesn't meet normal substitution analysis of a few cents or, you know, a couple of percentage points that people will substitute. People really care about Coke. Given that, we need to think about what types of innovation-enhancing approaches we can have. And if the markets really are much narrower than we think, then we should be much more concerned about action within the scope of the patent right. That brings us back to misuse and other doctrines, which activists seem to suggest should be relooked at. Finally, I'll end by quoting from some more recent scholarship from a guy named G.F. Hagel. The differing interests of producers and consumers may come into collision with each other, and though a fair balance between them on the whole may be brought about automatically, still their adjustment also requires a control which stands above both and is consciously undertaken. Let's learn to love price regulation, because it's here anyway. We'll do it. Let's just try to do it better. Thank you.
Now for something completely different.
Well, Mr. Josh. I didn't blow up. I'm perfectly calm.
Steal the space.
That's a trespass.
Sir. It's a huge amount.
Former Professor Wright on leave, which means I'm now a commissioner of the Federal Trade Commission, and I see cameras, which usually means before I talk, I say something like, the things I say attribute to people, don't attribute to people other than me at the commission, especially the other commissioners.
I always just say they're not even my own views.
Yeah, so occasionally I do that, and in this case, and also when I have the pleasure of following Richard on a panel, I usually get to be brief. I say, what Richard said, and I sit down, and in this case, and particularly the point, about when it comes to antitrust analysis of intellectual property rights, the economic tools that have been developed in standard antitrust analysis, and the doctrine that have been developed in standard antitrust analysis, I think are right for the job, and do not call for any sort of particularized exception or special approach. And it may, for the record, the standard approach also works for Coke and Pepsi. So instead of talking about sort of the general relationship between antitrust and IP, I thought because I would just say, hey, what Richard said, I think I thought I would talk about a couple of things going on in the intellectual property and antitrust sphere at the Federal Trade Commission. And in the interest of time, I will pick two. And the first is there's been some mention of trolls, PAEs, whatever the moniker of the day is you would like to use. And the FTC, as some of you know, has sent out for public comment its notice and request for comments on a proposal to use its 6B authority to study patent assertion entities. The debate around PAEs is well known. Policymakers and commentators have been very, very critical. There is a great deal of scholarship surrounding patent trolls, some presuming they do more harm than good, some presuming they do more good than harm, far more of the former than the latter. This is a place where the Federal Trade Commission historically, in areas that have been sort of devoid of empirical fact but full of very strong priors, has been, I think, productive in using its research authority and its capabilities. A wonderful team of full-time economists over there to get data and go to work and try to provide some answers that might be useful. So the types of things that the study tries to answer, sort of as laid out in the proposed notice, are things I would categorize with my economist hat on as largely descriptive analysis. How are PAEs organized in terms of legal structure? The differences in patterns and types of ownership compared to practicing entities? How does acquisition take place? What about comparing licensing activities? And as one might guess in any sort of study looking at those types of questions, maybe with an eye at getting toward the ultimate cost and benefits of those questions, the idea is to take and collect data with your group of interest, in this case PAEs, and also some other similarly situated firms, so you might be able to make some comparisons that you can learn from and inform the public debate. Whether the data collected will ultimately prove useful for that purpose, the descriptive purpose, I'm quite sure it will. But more broadly than that, we'll see. This is the trick about collecting data. The public comment period closes for that project on December 2nd, so your comments are welcome. For now, I think with respect to the PAE study, I'll sort of simply say I think for the agency, one of the things that the Federal Trade Commission, which when I had my professor hat on, spent a good amount of time criticizing a variety of their activities. Studying stuff is something that the commission does really well. Working with data and collecting data is something that they do well and are historically very careful with. And I think this is an area that's, I think devoid is the word I used before, and I'll stick to it. An area that is fairly devoid of empirical work. So I think the commission is well served to act here in terms of doing the study. I'll spend the rest of the time talking about reverse payments.
Ah, yes.
So the Supreme Court handed down activists not too long ago. The backdrop, of course, was that the Federal Trade Commission had for at least a decade, starting with former Chairman Muris and through Chairman Leibowitz and continuing now, long held the position that pay-for-delay settlements, I will call them, between brand and generic competitors, as Professor Sarnoff described them, were per se unlawful. That had been the position of the commission for quite some time. It was a debated position. There were folks saying that the right way to approach reverse payment settlements was with the rule of reason, and folks taking a variety of intermediate positions between sort of the full-blown rule of reason and treatment of per se illegality. The Supreme Court held that, and I think quite firmly and clearly, that reverse payments would be analyzed under the traditional rule of reason. The state of play prior to the decision was some circuits adopting the scope of the patent test, which Josh described, so I'll sort of move on from that other than come back to one interesting point about the extent to which questions about the validity of the patent will arise within the standard antitrust analysis. This is, in my view, again, disclaimer thing, speaking for myself, this is, in my view, pretty clearly a partial victory and a partial defeat for the FTC. One of the positions taken through the scope of the patent test and in other areas was that the settlement, reverse settlements ought to be per se lawful. Harking back to Richard's earlier comments, the standard antitrust analysis, that would almost certainly not be the case for any sort of horizontal agreement that had some of the features that these settlements can have. There's clearly some threat, potential threat to competition. The standard antitrust analysis when we have things that can potentially threaten competition, but may also be efficient, is to apply the rule of reason and to test the various anti-competitive and pro-competitive theories against the facts on the ground and ask whether the agreements actually confer some market power to the collective parties that would not exist otherwise. The activist decision does precisely that. It rejects it rejects per se treatment. It rejects scope of the patent test or something closer to per se legality. And so what we have is a decision that endorses the rule of reason. There is considerable debate over what precisely the contours of that rule of reason analysis will be. So many commentators, for example, have said, yes, the Supreme Court said this is not a so-called quick look rule of reason, one of these intermediate forms where we may say we're doing the rule of reason, but wink at each other and summarily condemn the restraint. The Supreme Court said we are not doing that thing. We are doing something else. We're doing the traditional rule of reason. They laid out some factors to consider. And one that got a lot of ink was the size of the payment. With an underlying a theory of economic logic that the larger the payment, the weaker the underlying patent is likely to be. And so the Supreme Court said, we'll look at the things we look at in a normal rule of reason analysis, but hey, pay special attention to the size of the payment. Some have said, what they really meant is if the payment's big, we summarily condemn the agreement, a la quick look rule of reason. I think a close read of the opinion, even a kind of sort of close read of the opinion suggests that that approach is wrong. I think instead, what a move from per se legality or per se illegality towards the rule of reason means is something like what it has meant in every other area of antitrust law that has moved from per se treatment to the rule of reason. More rigorous economic analysis, more attention to economic evidence rather than less. This, of course, will, and I don't think we actually disagree on this point at all, this will require looking at the size of the payment and deciding what inferences to draw from that to determine whether there has been harm to competition. Whether one labels that price regulation, I think, would be the thing that I would fight over, but I don't think there's sort of much time to do that. The idea that an antitrust court sometimes look at prices is different to say that we put in orders that fix prices or that, you know, so far as I know, Trinco and 9X and Rambus are all still the law of the land in the case of unilateral refusal to deal and throughout Section 2, which I'll say something akin to the monopolist gets to price the way it wants to price. Now, if it does something with its monopoly power to further harm competition, that's an antitrust problem. That analysis sometimes looks at prices or prices relative to cost or changes in prices to infer whether market power has been achieved, I think, is follows from standard economic logic, but doesn't require price regulation in the sense of the word that, at least as I understand it. I think back to activists for two closing points. I think there are two really important live questions. Lower courts haven't got their hands on post-activist rule of reason reverse payment cases yet. And I think there are two important questions. The court says size of the payment really matters. So what constitutes, as the court said, a large and unjustified payment, the court says, makes it more likely a settlement is illegal. Not necessarily illegal, but more likely. So what is large and unjustified? You hand that part of the opinion to anybody who has done any economics or statistics in their life, they will say, large and unjustified compared to what? How are we going to measure largeness and the lack of justification? It is difficult for me to fathom that that analysis won't bring more economic rigor to understanding the incentives to enter these settlements than less. One thing you could do is compare to the expected litigation cost. You can try to. I think it's one easy prediction about the case is that the settlements will get more complicated. They will have more features. It will be more difficult to tease out what is being paid for what. But exactly how courts will structure what to do with the size of the payment, I think, is an open question. That's one of the very important ones that I think will be resolved fairly quickly. The second interesting question, and Professor Sarnoff got at this a little bit, is what to do about patent validity within the antitrust analysis. So there is a vigorous dissent in the opinion that adopts the logic, and there's certainly some intuitive appeal to it, that were the patent valid, the patent holder has a right to exclude, and a lesser offense of paying somebody to delay entry is certainly sort of within the rights of a valid patent holder. So there could be no harm to competition in the sense meant by the antitrust laws if we knew with certainty that the patent was valid. The majority rejects the scope of the patent test, and yet and still, under the more fulsome rule of reason analysis endorsed by the majority, I find, and this is my prediction, and $5 may get you a cup of coffee, but my prediction is that lower courts adopting this more fulsome rule of reason analysis will be very much inclined to consider the potential validity of the patent. With a Supreme Court decision that says, defendant, you are entitled to the full-blown rule of reason. You are entitled to put forth justifications for your settlement, justifications that may well include validity of the patent or other things. It is hard for me to imagine that the ultimate equilibrium of the sort of rule that arises in the lower courts will be one that turns a blind eye to the potential validity of the patent. That, I think, remains to be seen. But will be something that I think will be an important fork in the road for the development of these cases, and I'm sure one that the commission itself will be watching closely, as they've got a couple of pending cases, and I am quite certain plan to bring a couple more. So I will stop there.
Okay, John Duffy, my impersonation of a potted plant is over. If you want to take up to a minute or possibly two with cross comments, you may do so.
I do have one cross comment that this is, I find, irresistible. And I think everybody on this room is going to figure out why it's irresistible, because I'm going to be on the right of Richard Epstein. On this, I'm literally on his right, but I'm going to be also metaphorically on his right. He said in his speech that one thing that he would recommend is doubling the appropriation of the Patent and Trademark Office. Okay, now that I have to take issue with. I think it's the standard liberal solution that when you see a government agency that is not performing well, you say, what should we do with it? Oh, it would work very well if we just doubled the appropriation. And that's the standard liberal solution. Now, let me tell you what's wrong with the Patent and Trademark Office. They spend, on average, about 20 hours looking over a patent. Let's say you said 40 hours is what's necessary. No. Still, this is what they do when you come to the patent office with a patent application. What they're giving you is expert services, an expert opinion. It's not for sure valid. It only has a presumption of validity. It gets some weight in court. Imagine if you went in the private market to an expert witness and you said, I need about 20, 30, maybe 40 hours worth of your time. That person said, oh, I can do that for you. I can charge you a fair price. I'll do that for you. And I can do it in about 2016, I think I'll get around to it. You would think, what's going on here? You'd think, is this like the Soviet Union? You'd think, this is the only way this kind of service could possibly exist is if this is a monopolized entity. And that's exactly what the Patent Office is in this country, but not in other countries. I have an article on this. It's called Ending the Patenting Monopoly. Not ending the patent monopoly, because I don't think there are patent monopolies, but ending the patenting monopoly, which is the USPTO. Other countries don't do it this way. Israel, for example, you can go to any one of 13 patent offices throughout the world, and if you're able to convince them to get a patent, they will then issue immediately, by law, operation of law, an Israeli patent. That's a step towards competition. I think that you could have full-blown privatization of the examination function. And you can read that article. Now, that's the free market solution, the competitive solution. John, if you want the liberal solution, you go to Richard. Yeah.
Why is that competitive? There are 13 jurisdictions that could issue a patent. Why are they competing with each other?
We show in this article that there are examples where they are competing and competing on price with other patent offices. But the full article actually suggests allowing private entities to do this. Obviously, having some sort of certification to make sure that they are producing quality opinions about validity. But that kind of regulation you could have, and you could then have a sector in the economy that engages in deciding whether patents are valid or not and examining them. And in fact, there's actually a growing set of technology companies that are trying to figure out whether issued patents are valid or not, because there is a private demand for that, because basically you can't trust the patent office. So this is new technology. This would allow for entrepreneurship, and it would get rid of a government monopoly that's performing terribly. That's my solution. But if you want the standard liberal solution, which is to double the patent office's appropriation, you can talk to Richard here.
You are going to have to talk to Richard. I mean, and let me see if I can explain in a little bit more fulsome detail my situation. First of all, one of the things about situations when you create quote-unquote monopolies in the sense of exclusive rights is that it's very difficult to have competitive organizations to license them. It would like be having you go to 13 rival parties in order to figure out whether or not a land title is valid. The risk in this particular case is you get one country which says, we will now be the schlock patent service. We will give you validity situations. You have to license it within our system. And if it turns out that that guy has very inferior services which are attractive to a plaintiff, what you do is you have a huge externality. So it's not at all clear to me that the multiplicity of parties is in fact going to be good. Sooner or later, you're going to have to focus on the question of validity. Now, John may be right, and I was not.
That's the race to the bottom theory.
It is a race to the bottom theory in this particular context, given the fact that the complications is going to be valid somewhere else. Now, if it turns out these guys have to live with their decision, so Germany's doing it, I think it would be fine. But if it's the Bahamas or the Cayman Islands that are doing this, I'm going to get very suspicious. The point about the money was, I'm sorry I spoke too briefly, is obviously you've got to reform the particular operation of this thing in order for the situation to be valid. But there was this proposal with respect to the FDA in which if you paid an additional sum of money, you got an expedited examination, which as best I can tell seemed to work pretty well. Tom Phillipson did a bunch of studies on this thing and found that essentially the quality of the review did not go down as the speed of the review started to go up.
Richard, why wouldn't why wouldn't crummy patents opinions from Cayman or wherever simply be a plaintiff magnet? Well, so you wouldn't want that. You'd want one from Germany or UK.
Well, I mean, it depends on, exactly the switches and so forth. I can perfectly believe the fact. But he's saying, in effect, what it is doing, you're going to give it the same effect in your system as you would give it everywhere else. And obviously, the only way this system will work, and I think it's probably the right thing, is to say we care less about what the PTA does and more about the way in which the courts start to work. And I put this thing up because, if, as you well know, the current situation is to allow the PTO under the AIA to trump, at least in some circumstances, what it is a district court has done, right, on the reexamination procedure. I fought that very seriously because, frankly, I think that's just the worst possible way to do it, given the way the adjudication is going to run. So let me now just modify my system, which is I'm perfectly willing to give more money if I think there's a bottleneck and delay, which is something that you referred to, but I'm not willing to give it unconditionally. I would want to have some major structural reforms start to take place in there, and it's as always the difficult. It's not the liberal solution in some sense. I mean, there are certain other kinds of cases, I dare say, where we would like to put a little bit more money in the public side. Certainly with respect to the enforcement of real estate titles, you would not want to have a shoddy system of recordation that could create all sorts of difficulties. So let me put it this way and modify it, because I'm duly chastened, which is I'm willing to spend money to make a system more cost-effective, and I think one of the constant complaints with the patent office is that the money that they raise goes back into the general treasury. The delay becomes acute, and if in fact you could control the delay problem, it seems to me that that would be independent of everything else, some kind of an improvement. So I will put it this way. If you could keep quality and control delay and spend less money on it, I'm in favor of that, too.
Refinement noted. Josh?
Sure. So let me pick up on this discussion and relate it back to activists.
I'm not sure.
Prosecutors spent something between $10,000 and $100,000 acquiring patents. We litigate $5 million to $25 million over what they mean and whether they're valid and infringed. The solution is not simply to give more money to the patent office, although I'm actually in favor of that as
How
well.
How about judges? Start make us judging.
I'm absolutely in favor.
The Motorola Mobility opinion is 207 pages to set that price. That's, you know, exactly. I think we should get piecework here.
You know, there's nothing that says you can't impose as part of the damages award something coming back to you. So, in any event,
now you tell me.
I'll just give you one example, and here I can refer you to my amicus brief in the Phillips case dealing with claim construction. It's now effectively rewritten in somebody else's cert petition in the BioSig case, which is that the standard for whether a patent claim is valid is whether it is not insolubly ambiguous. It can be very ambiguous, just not insolubly ambiguous, which means that you can't know what the scope of the property right is and whether it's valid or infringed till you after you pay this guy to resolve it in court. That is the basic difference between the patent system and most other forms of property system. Okay, we're going to say you can define the boundary so long as you can get to court and figure out where the boundaries are. If someone then asserts that claim in court, the problem is you've got a misuse of the patent right where you ought to know that it actually doesn't cover the thing you're asserting. This brings us back to how are we going to actually do the evaluations in the context of courts having to assess what value is being transferred. You're going to have to get to some extent into these difficult and costly questions, $5 to $25 million in litigation costs before trial, to figure out whether or not the patent was valid and infringed. It also turns out that the markets for generics versus the pioneers are not perfectly elastic. And this is being done in many ways, including the agreements not to offer authorized generics by the manufacturer as a way of transferring value to the generics during the term. So you've got to think through much more carefully, and this just makes it more costly, and once again, take a cut, because it's going to come back to the courts. You know, you're going to have to evaluate whether or not these patents, with all of these complex doctrines, but the best place to start on patent validity is something the AIA really didn't help at all with, which is clarifying claim scope.
Yeah, they got it.
Does the AIA provision allowing for post-issuance review have anything to contribute to this? If it comes into court, could I say, I'm going to send it over to PTO for a post-issuance review, or could I engage them as my expert?
So you have two different problems with that. The first is the one that Professor Epstein alludes to. If the court has already said, for example, that the patent claim is invalid, bringing it back into the patent office and claiming it's valid seems troubling. Same thing with the other way around.
No, I'm talking about in terms of trying to sort out a pay-for-delay case.
Right. The problem with that is that there's a different standard that's currently being adopted in the Patent Office on post-grant reviews, which is broadest reasonable interpretation. That's supposed to allow for more claims to be found invalid, but if they are upheld, then they are less likely to, or more likely to be infringed. So we don't know, are we going to, in these cases, use and transfer it to a different standard which sets a different scope to each of the claims, then bring it back to decide whether or not the judicial determination, which should have been made under a different standard, is the proper one. They need to sort that out.
Because if they did say it's not valid even with a broad scope, that solves the problem.
Doug, it's worse than that. Right. I mean, one of the problems is that the way in which you get federal judges today is kind of by a random draw, because people are very nervous about the self-selection. If you go into the PTO under the AIA, as best I can tell by reading it, is that the head of that court has complete discretion on appointing special judges on an ad hoc basis in order to hear these cases. I regard that provision actually as unconstitutional because I think it's an open invitation for bias if, in fact, you know what the patent is, you know what the claim is, and you know what your friends are. So I don't like that system there. I would much rather them have a stable of judges in a given area or people who can do this, and then you pick them by lot in order to handle the case, because the effort to sort of match it by way of ability seems to me to be much too much open to real claims of bias, which are going to be very difficult to challenge after the fact.
And bias, expertise, they get confused.
I'll just add one last thing. If it has to go to the court to figure out what the claim means, you're already too far in with too much money on the table.
Yeah. Okay. Commish?
So I talked mostly about PAEs, where I think the punchline is going to rule of reason is taking us back to sort of a normal antitrust mode. Let me make these remarks on something that I think is going the other direction, where I think antitrust law and the enforcement agencies are maybe, and at least there are the seeds of a departure from the normal situation in which the agencies treat patents as property. Indeed, that's the language that appears in our 95 licensing guidelines on IP, and I think has been the traditional approach with horizontal agreements, with whether or not patents confer market power, which is the Supreme Court gets right and says there's no presumption of that sort. So a couple areas that I think are cause for concern, that there are at least seeds that the antitrust agencies, and including my employer, are maybe heading a different direction into a realm of special treatment for intellectual property rights. Most of this goes to the injunction issue that Richard started with. I think there has been some momentum inside the agencies for the view, and I think a view that is quite contrary to the position that would occur in the space of real property, that injunctions are suspect as a competitive matter, as an antitrust matter. And so if you run down the line, most of these examples are bootstrapping on the proposition that the uses of that injunctions are competitively suspect. It's a proposition that I don't think has been established and cannot be established as a matter of economics or law. But if you begin with that presumption, then you can start to read through some recent agency activity. Settlements under the FTC Section 5 authority, a couple cases that occurred before I started, or else I'd just be reading my dissent, that have to do with assertions that the naked assertion of an injunction on a FRAND encumbered SEP violates Section 5 of the FTC Act. Couldn't do it under the Sherman Act. Couldn't do it under the Sherman Act precisely because the conduct would not be unlawful. Merger review in which the competitive problem identified is that the post-merger firm, because it's acquiring some IP, maybe it's acquiring some standard essential patents, well, it's more likely to seek injunctions. Well, so what's your antitrust theory of harm? More likely to seek injunctions. Injunctions are competitively suspect, ergo, the merger is more likely, makes the post-merger firm more of a competitive problem. Bootstrapping on the problematic premise. There are other examples. some popularity with the idea that a similar merger example that would instead be a transfer of patents to a from a practicing entity to a PAE would raise the same problems. Why? Because the PAE is more likely to go get an injunction. And finally, related to the first example of the FTC cases, that breach of a contract with an SSO instead is itself, in particular, breach of a contract involving a FRAN commitment are presumptively anti-competitive, not presumptively inefficient, not presumptively breach of contract, not presumptively some sort of other problem or non-problem, but presumptively an antitrust violation, presumptively the result of the acquisition of market power. I think putting some of those examples together, again, I think which all have this one premise in common, are importantly a departure from the standard approach, or at least the beginnings thereof.
Okay, we have 14 minutes for some questions from you all. So there's a microphone I see there in the center. Just tell us who you are.
And why you're here.
And even if you think we already know, it would be helpful.
Good afternoon, Art Mackember. I'm a dirt lawyer from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And I'm seeing some market similarities between what we call in real property a quiet title action, which sometimes goes along with a declaratory judgment. And I'm wondering if there's such a thing in patent law that we call adverse possession, especially perhaps related to these paper patents that were mentioned, and how that gets resolved in the patent system.
John, can you handle that briefly?
Sure. You want me to focus mainly on adverse possession?
Yeah.
The adverse possession, we haven't seen that really in patent law, I think because the standard idea of an adverse possession is usually that you have to be in possession of the property in an open and notorious way for something along the lines of two decades, which is the term of the patent.
Yeah.
So it would expire anyway. So I don't think we've seen that doctrine of real property migrate into patent law. I will say that there is a very interesting Supreme Court case this term on copyright about whether the doctrine of the equitable doctrine of latches applies to copyright infringement claims so that for complex reasons, the statute of limitations sort of is a rolling statute of limitations. And there's an argument, the Ninth Circuit held, that still there's a doctrine of latches, so that somebody who's been using a film, the film Raging Bull, as a matter of fact, for years and years and years, and somebody knew about their potential claim against them for copyright infringement, but they let it sit for years and years and years, that claim might be barred forever by the doctrine of latches. So I guess that's the only place where I could see it, where it currently exists in intellectual property. I don't know of anything in patent law that's similar, although latches occasionally has been seen in patent law too. So I guess that's where I'd look. Not adverse possession. I'd look to the doctrine of latches to accomplish the similar thing.
And just one sentence. The reason why that doctrine makes perfectly good sense is the issue of latches is something within the control of the patent holder, whereas many of the other defenses under the eBay balancing tests are not.
Josh?
The one thing is that because this is non-rivalrous property, you don't get the same context. What you do get under patent law is the denial of an injunction with a prospective royalty, effectively the same thing in a non-rivalrous property situation.
Interesting. Yes, sir.
I'm Sam Miarelli from Orlando. I'm a member of the Practice Group's Executive Committee. I'm wondering, a lot of this discussion has been about drugs, and increasingly we're seeing these combination drugs where often something immediately goes generic and you see it combined with something that's still patented, like Vytorin, but also especially in the HIV treatment where you have essentially a patient needs one drug out of, or three different classes of drugs. And we're starting to see that as some of these have gone generic, the two or three manufacturers won't sell the generic as a generic, and they require it to be in a combination drug, a triplet, Truvada, these other sorts of things. And so essentially they create a 20 or 30 year, or presumably you could even see like a 40 or 60 year patent on these drugs, and you never see the public good. And I'm wondering how you see these sort of antitrust issues potentially affecting that practice.
Would you say that's similar to evergreening in other ways, you know, changing the shape, changing the color, what have you?
Exactly, and you see a minor refinement, and maybe the slightly less refined version that was 98% effective, you can't buy anymore, and now you have to get the 99% effective combined with these other presumably generic drugs, but still at sky-high prices.
Now, why is it you can't buy the 98% variety?
They withdraw from the orange book.
It's because it's dropped from the orange book, right?
It's government regulation.
Yeah, and the point that it's not a patent problem. Look, the FDA is supposed to tell you whether a drug is safe and effective. Once it's safe and effective, it remains safe and effective even after it's dropped from the orange book. So the standard rule of patents ought to apply, and the patent rule essentially is if you patent an improvement, you cannot prevent anybody from using the unimproved drug at whatever price you want. And so now it's the FDA in restraint of trade with its orange book regulations, and those ought to be changed forthwith.
So the key there is not a patent problem. It is a healthcare problem of the intricacies of healthcare regulation, which produce this opportunity for this. You don't see evergreening even discussed in any other area of technology. Yeah.
There are two other complexities. One is why the generics didn't move in to supply the third drug that went off the patent, and that's one concern. That's maybe a regulatory concern. The other is whether or not they will sell, say there were three patented drugs all sold separately, whether the brand manufacturer will continue to sell them separately so there's no benefit. That may raise some antitrust concerns, but the bigger question is usually why the doctors, where there's no therapeutic increase, are now requiring the branded drug. That's about bad medical practice and the need for a regulation of the healthcare industry.
Well, maybe, but okay. I mean, the difficulty in some of those cases is that the small changes have huge impacts. And it's really very, very difficult to make some of these claims out until you actually know what's going on there. At this point, you get group buyers, HMOs, professional organizations, hospitals, and to somehow or other assume that these characters are buying stuff which is more expensive even though they know it's not better is, I think, a somewhat questionable one.
It does sound like the Soviet system.
But it is.
Oh God, don't get the FDA is a Soviet tank. There's no question.
Hey, listen. I tried to make the point on Abigail Alliance, right?
Yeah, so we did. Some of us know.
Okay,
amen,
sir.
Amen, brother.
Nick Chidiak. I'm the president of the George Washington University chapter. So, Professor Epstein, in your comments about the quality of the scholarship on the patent system, you talked a lot about scholars have a tendency to sort of, you know, zero in on some sort of core in the system and sort of miss some of the larger overarching effects. In regards to the reverse payment settlements, our analysis usually starts well after the a drug company has done a lot of risk assessment, a lot of planning, a lot of investment, yeah, both developing the drug, taking it to market, and after generic firms have individually and the plurality of them decided whether to or not to file an ANDA. What are we missing in terms of the overall economic dynamics?
Right question. I have a modest proposal, which I've made on other occasions to the horrific response of everybody, which says, let's assume that what you get from a successful challenge under title paragraph 4 is a 6-month co-exclusivity period, right? My solution to all these problems is let them cartelize the market for the period in question.
Just a second. We're in Hatch-Waxman now. The first generic comes along,
yes,
fails, everyone else is precluded.
Yes,
right?
For okay, the 6 months. Right. Right? And the reason is, what you're doing is you've got two margins to worry about, an administrative cost. The one margin is whether or not at the time that the dispute is resolved, there's going to be increased levels of competition, and my thing will preclude it. But on the other hand, you save a bushel load of expenses because nobody has a test worth of powder to blow it to hell on how you value the reverse settlement. But on the other hand, there's another margin, which if it turns out that you think that pharmaceutical patents are A, very solid generally, and B, too short, adding 6 months to it may spur the initial creation because, you know, even if you're challenged, it will be a little bit more valuable than before. So given a full-time evaluation, which is what you're talking about, I see very little reason to believe that we begin the analysis at the point of the dispute and think it's much more important to go back. And the best way to challenge a patent is to encourage new entry by a substitute commodity. And that can be done if the new guy knows that if his patent is challenged and he works out a settlement, he too gets 6 months. It's a little bit of what John constantly wanted to say, is that the action at the front end protects you at the back end.
Next.
Hi, I'm Craig Fratrick, a student at Harvard Law School. So I want to defend the difference, because it seemed like there was a decent amount of agreement on intellectual property being a lot like regular or real property. And so some differences that came to my mind, as you all have covered, is the 3-year waiting period to find out if you have the property is quite different than, you know, if I construct something, I own it, or it is relatively easy. If I sign the title to the land, then I know I own it right then. And then the other big one was just locality. So it is relatively easy for you to look at your house that you're considering buying or investing retail in, look at the registry, and then see if you own it. And coming from I was a software programmer before, and coming from the software industry, it is literally impossible to build a relatively simple website and then know if you are infringing on someone else's property, right? So given those constraints, isn't there some room left to distinguish intellectual property from property?
Well, this is my response to that question, since I think it's addressed to me. One of the reasons why we encourage patent pools amongst complementary goods and cross-licensing arrangements is to take these little things of property and make them into larger plots to make them usable. You don't have to do that with respect to land for the most part, except under very unusual circumstances. For example, if you want oil and gas leases, now the efficient magnitude is much larger than the farm, and you have a lot of the similar kinds of assembly problems that need responses. And on the other point, I think, again, you're right. The attractiveness of a real property system is that meets and bounds give you solid boundaries over which you could work. Gary Leiberkamp has done some wonderful work saying where they don't give you the standard coordinates through the surveyors but use landmarks and so forth, the value of the real estate goes down by 30% precisely because of the insecurity of title. And so Duffy may be right or he may be wrong on the question of how the examination ought to work. But the key point is that you want to have a system that gives you secure titles at the front end and allows for these cross-licensing arrangements, because if they're not secure, then forget about litigation. Think first about licensing. The amount that you could get on an insecure license or a mortgage or anything else is going to be very much less, just as it is in real property.
Josh Wright, briefly, and then one last question.
With respect to the symmetry point on property and intellectual property, I mean, from an antitrust perspective, I think the answer is the benefit of the symmetry approach of having the antitrust analysis treat the two the same is not a claim that they are identical, and it's not something that hamstrings the agencies to say, we have to pretend that this property right has all the same economic features as this one, no more than we do when we have a case where there's other, you know, there's a regulatory institution in the background or this market is different than that market. So it's allowing one to take the facts on the ground, but say we don't need a special set of rules. We don't need a different framework for analyzing. Our analysis is see whether the conduct at issue creates incentives that allow the acquisition of market power. Same question.
We go off the air in 1 minute. Your question, sir.
I'm David Warder from the DC Young Lawyers chapter. My question is for Professor Epstein. Would you change the qualifications needed at the PTO to hire patent examiners? And for Professor Duffy, what would your private examiner certification look like?
Okay, well, my answer to the question is I'm not a management consultant. And if the proposition is, can we improve the post office, the answer is surely yes. And what's true of the post office is I also think true with respect to the PTO. But it's not going to be small incremental changes you need. You need to have somebody come in there with a new broom that will sweep clean.
And John, I think that new broom is privatization. I think you'd see a lot of different things. Like, for example, I think you would not see unionization of many of the shops, currently, the current shop is unionized. I think that's one thing that we've
got. That's unconstitutional, right? Okay. In any sensible world.
We've had a terrific panel. Please thank them for me.